Sergeant Quatter. You say the river bottom is sanded.
Right, sir. The river bottom is sandy, sir.
Good. Have you any knowledge of trees?
I was born in one, sir.
Good. You see those wooden ones across the river?
Personally, sir.
Think you could chop them down?
Not from here, sir.
Well, get Private Blix. He's a lumberjack.
I'm sorry, sir. He's bed down at 10B, sir. Got a broken arm, sir. Can't chop down trees with a broken arm, sir.
Couldn't he try an axe?
Hello. Huh?
Field Marshal Eccles, how are you getting on as a sanitary orderly?
I want to speak to you about that. Since I've been doing that job, the men make me sleep outside in the snow.
Snow? Snow in Burma?
No, Switzerland. That's where they make me go.
Welcome to Goompod. Now, we talk about the goons, of course, but very often, almost every episode, there's at least one reference to the Beatles. And more often than not, there's also a reference to the Beatles producer, George Martin. And my guest today is a gentleman who has a very wide and varied interest in George Martin, to the extent that he has a podcast celebrating George Martin's work, predominantly with the Beatles, both as a collective and individually. I think that's fair to say. It's Jason Krupa from the podcast Producing the Beatles.
Hello, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to talk about this.
Yeah, when I said that about, so it's producing the Beatles, but it's also, I mean, you've covered Live and Let Die very recently, haven't you?
Right. The main thrust is Beatles together, but I just thought I'd try something after the first season, just a few bonus episodes on solo songs. So I've done a John song, two George songs, just because I co-wrote a book on the making of All Things Must Pass, and I had a lot of material.
Oh, yeah.
And then Live and Let Die. You know, I say that it's about the Beatles, but it's, and definitely it is about the Beatles, but I'm using that also as an excuse to teach music and to talk about how recordings are made and how technology worked back then. And, you know, really how collaboration works.
Great. Okay. And your name's Jason Krupa. No relation to Gene, I take it.
There is a family story, which I've only recently sort of confirmed that we're distantly related. My last name is spelled Kruppa. His is Krupa. Both Hungarian. And my brother recently found confirmation that there is a relation. The reason the names are different, this is more than you probably want to get into, but the reason the names are different is because his ancestor in the 19th century came over first, and that was the original name, and then my ancestor, direct ancestor, came over, who was his brother or cousin or something, and okay. To differentiate, he added an extra P, and so okay. we've recently found documentation to that. So I'm going to say, short answer is yes.
Brilliant. I can't think of any other famous notable groupers, to be honest.
No, I don't think
that's
so.
About it. You and Gene.
Yes. Yeah. I wouldn't say I'm quite as famous as Gene, but you know, give me time.
I think originally you suggested coming on to talk about George Martin's work with, you know, Peter and Spike in the 50s and the 60s. But around the time that you suggested that, I think I was in the process of beginning to record an episode about George Martin with Andrew Hickey.
Yes.
So you slightly missed the boat on that. But you then suggested that you'd like to come on and talk about the 1962 LP that Spike, Peter and Friends recorded, which is the famous Bridge on the River Wye LP. Produced by George Martin.
Yes.
Of course. It borrowed heavily, the script borrowed heavily from the Goon Show episode African Incident from the 8th series
right.
of the Goon Show. Have you heard that?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. I've actually listened to it again last night, but I will maybe get into this. I don't want to interrupt you.
Okay. Okay. Before we started recording, I asked you if you've come on to talk about Bridge on the River Wye, and I guess it's mainly off the back of your interest in George Martin. So I said, prior to us hitting record, I said, did you have an interest in the Goons as well? And you said to me, yeah, but it kind of came about because of your interest in George Martin. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Right. So, I mean, let's even back up a little farther than that. About 20 years ago, I got obsessed with the Revolver album. And I started looking into, how all those sounds were made, how they did all they did. There were really no books on this. I mean, obviously, Mark Lewisohn's books, which are very important. But really, going into the background of how they accomplished all of this in their recordings. And as I began looking and trying to figure this out, I realized that George Martin was really central to this. And then I started looking into his books and in interviews with him, and I started hitting this wall where there was, sort of this hint at, oh, well, these comedy recordings are really important, but that was it. There was no study of the comedy recordings. There was no one who had really done any research in depth. There were a few titles that were, Martin had mentioned and that came up in internet searches, but a lot of it was just a blank. And I thought, this, there's something here. I have to dig deeper. So I started collecting all of this material and reading and obviously ran into Peter Sellers and Spike Milligan and the Goons. And I was already familiar with Peter Sellers. I grew up in the 70s. So my parents were big fans of the Pink Panther films. And I came to see some of his other films, Dr. Strangelove and Being There, sort of as I got older. And then I became more interested, just in general through film, I think, too. And so all of these threads started to come together. And once I started realizing how important the recordings with Peter Sellers were, I dug deeper into that. And eventually it turned from strictly research about Revolver. I thought, I would do a book on Revolver back then. And I abandoned that. And then it became this really insane rabbit hole of George Martin's career, specifically with the Beatles, but also before the Beatles, and how that work informed his understanding of the studio and how that helped them be able to use the studio in a creative way. I met Mark Cousins in London. Mark Lewisohn introduced us, and he, obviously has a long history with Goon Show Preservation Society. And he gave me a disc of all the extant shows. This is many years ago. And so I listened to all of them during that period. And then, sort of went back and focused on specific ones. And then when I came to River Wye, I obviously dove into the African Incident. So
sure.
That's how all that's kind of developed and overlapped.
And as an American, how did you find the Goon Show in terms of was it completely incomprehensible when the first few you listened to?
Initially it was. I didn't expect it to be so fast. And
right.
I remember just listening and hanging on for dear life at first. and then, as I became more accustomed to it, I was able to follow it more closely. And I listened to several episodes last night, actually, the African Incident and a few others, just to sort of refresh, because there were a couple of things I wanted to just check. And it seemed perfectly fine now. It was just that thing of becoming accustomed to the speed of it and the asides and, all the switches of accents, and then being able to identify who was speaking as what character. That took time. But yeah, I mean, I think I have a pretty good handle on it now.
Okay. Funny you mentioned Mark Cousins. I actually was in contact with him yesterday.
Oh.
Just asking him for some a couple of points about Bridge on the River Wye, actually. Yeah.
I sent him a lot of the paperwork I'd copied at EMI years ago, and I know he made trips himself, so he may have a few other things I don't have. I dug out as much Peter Sellers material and Spike material as they would give me, because some things have been misfiled, and, you know, they may show up later.
Yeah, yeah. If anyone knows anything about this LP, there's one fact that always, you know, if you read a Milligan biography or Sellers biography, if this LP gets mentioned at all, there's one fact that always gets trotted out. I'm sure you know what that is.
Yes.
It was originally going to be called Bridge on the River Kwai. And they actually got so far as actually recording it as Kwai throughout the recording.
Right.
And then because of complaints from, who would it have been? From
Columbia Pictures, I think.
Columbia Pictures.
Yeah.
George Martin had to go and clip out the K from the word Kwai.
Yes.
Which, re-listening to it myself this weekend, sometimes you barely notice the edit, but sometimes you really do, don't you?
Yeah, and I had really hoped to find a memo at EMI that confirmed this and laid it out and said, you must change this. But nothing, unfortunately. I didn't find any correspondence about this at all. I found session paperwork, but unfortunately nothing about that. One thing that I did notice is that it's really only mentioned, I think it's 8 times throughout the recording, and the edit was done after the voice recording, but prior to the sound effects and the orchestral overdubs. So it would have been relatively easy. It's not like they had to cut it out of a finished production.
Yeah.
We present The Bridge Over the River Kwai, subsequently The Lawsuit Over the River Kwai, and finally Ministry of Hygiene Annual Report on the River Kwai.
But it is nonsensical, because the story is exactly the same. And the sleeve note, I don't know if you've seen the back of the LP, which I have here. It's just ridiculous. So they're not fooling anybody, but because if you listen to it, you know exactly what's going on.
Are you fond of the film?
Yes, I haven't actually seen it in a long time, but I'm a big Alec Guinness fan, and Man in the White Suit, and you know all those 50s films. And there's another connection to George Martin, Man in the White Suit, which we won't get on that tangent. But anyway.
Oh, no, go on.
Well, he had produced a recording of the theme tune with a bit of the gurgling sound effect in that film.
Oh, okay, yes.
And he used that as a cue to the recording. I think it was Jack Parnell was the artist. And so that's the beginning of the recording. And it's this early example of musique concrète where he's taking a found sound and he's working it into a piece of music.
That's interesting. Right, okay. So, Bridge on the River Kwai, the film, it's about 8 hours long.
Right.
But I only saw it for the first time a couple of years ago and I really enjoyed it. And it is amazing. Well, it is quite notable how closely this LP, the script of this LP, follows the script of Bridge on the River Kwai. Obviously not totally faithfully, but
no, the general shape of it, though.
The general shape of it. Each major scene in the film has its corresponding scene in this, and it's interesting as well, because more and more doing this podcast and taking time to actually look at the historical context when the Goon shows were written and broadcast, more and more I'm finding out that Spike was writing parodies of film and television programs, in some cases, you know, literally 2-3 weeks after the film or television series
that film premiered in October and then into wider release later in the month, and this was out in December. African Incident. Yeah. So yeah, really quickly.
Yeah. So I don't really know. I've not been able to find out very much at all about the background to the recording of this, of the LP, the 1962 LP.
Right.
So we do know that it was recorded on Wednesday, the 23rd of May. Now, Mark Cousins believes that it was all done in a morning.
Yes. The recording sheet said they had booked out two sessions, one morning and one afternoon after lunch break. And yeah. But they finished everything by 1 o'clock, and so they packed up and went home. May 23rd, Studio 2.
Wow. But then again, you think about it, it's 33 minutes in length in total,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And if you think, you know, the Goon Show a couple of years before, Spike and Peter were doing this every week.
Yeah.
More or less. Do we know who came up with the idea of recording this and why?
Well, the short version of that is I think it was George Martin. And the reason I believe that is a much longer answer. I don't know if this is where you want to really get into the background, but it's probably as good a time as any to give you the wide view of this and then zoom in.
One thing that interests me is that less than a month before, George had been best man at Spike's wedding.
Right.
And I was wondering if... No, because it would have been too soon. They couldn't have just decided,
right?
You know, during the oh, by the way, breakfast. Yeah,
on that hectic car ride up to Lead, you know,
that's right. Yeah, just... so I just you just wondered. But so what? You said you've got a rather sort of labyrinthine supposition. So
right.
Go ahead.
So we know. I mean, general knowledge is that George Martin, by the late 50s, had come to understand that, you know, comedy was a niche that he could begin exploring and, you know, began putting more energy into that, began having more hits with those records. And part of that was that he began recording comedy albums, not just singles, you know, Charlie Drake and various things like that, but also albums. So At the Drop of the Hat is the first mm-hmm. Iteration of that with Flanders and Swann. And, you know, then he followed that with Best of Sellers and the other two Sellers albums, two more Flanders and Swann albums. In all, he released 20 of what we could call comedy LPs. And the majority of those are either transcriptions of stage shows. They're the two Best of the Goon Shows LPs. Mm-hmm. There's the That Was the Week That Was, which was just, you know, a bunch of TV skits that he added together into an LP. So this space that I'm talking about, where he does these 20 albums, is between 57 and 65. And he's still producing these into the Beatles period.
Yeah.
But there are seven in particular, The Best of Sellers, Swingin' Sellers, Peter and Sophia, Milligan Preserved, It's a Square World with Michael Benteen, Combination of Cribbins with Bernard Cribbins, pardon me,
Well done. You self-corrected yourself.
Self-corrected. And the peak of this is Bridge on the River Wye. This I think is the sort of the pinnacle of his comedy productions. It's an ambitious recording. He puts a lot of effort into this. And you know, historically, the leap that happens is that he's done this. He's learned how to use the studio in this very creative, dramatic way. And then he meets the Beatles, or as he's making this, he meets the Beatles. And then those techniques slowly begin to become Beatle techniques. The reason I say I think it was his idea, I have a letter here from George Martin to Michael Flanders,
right.
February 1960. And he's in the midst of making these, you know, more of these albums, and he proposes to him using two of the Flanders and Swann songs, Wom Pom and In the Bath, for what he calls a mixed album of first-class humorists that he wants to release in the autumn. And nice. And he's proposing Ustinov's Mock Mozart and Phony Folklore and Gerald Hoffnung's address to the Cambridge Union, and he says one or two other tracks of similar quality. So he's pitching, this album is never compiled, never released, But he's, you know, he's pitching these ideas. He's thinking like, okay, I've got a rich vein here that I'm mining, and no one else is really doing this. I'm gonna see if I can, you know, make a little, you know, little money for Parlophone, or, you know, make a little impact on the charts. He's seeing some commercial value to this.
Sure. Yep.
So I think, you know, must have come in conversation with Spike at some point, whether it's during the wedding or, you know, that hectic drive or somewhere. You know, he might have said, you know, why don't we do one of the goon shows as an LP, like a properly produced LP.
Right.
And yeah. Behind, you know, he had done Milligan Preserved in 61. Yes. That was released in 61. And that took almost bits and pieces. This was all done sort of piecemeal over about a year, I think. And then the Michael Benteen LP was done over the course of 11 months off and on. And the Benteen LP is, I would say, almost as important as the River Y LP, because he put so much production work into that. Stuart Eltham, the engineer who worked with him very closely on these recordings, worked so hard on it that he actually gave him a sleeve credit, which engineers never got on projects like this. And Martin was putting his credit as produced by George Martin, not artist and repertoire, not recording manager, produced by George Martin. He really wanted to, you know, say, this is what I'm doing. I'm putting a stamp on this. So I think, you know, coming out of the production with the Sellers albums, with Spike, with the Benteen LP, I think he's looking for his next project that he can, you know, do something creative. And for whatever reason, I this was it.
Uh-huh. Here comes the old man. I better slip out of this dress.
Eyes front.
At ease, gentlemen. I understand you all wanted to see me.
Yes, we do.
Gopher, the men want to know what your views are on escaping, sir.
Escaping? Where from?
Here, sir.
Escaping from here? Oh. Is it something I've said?
Well, one of the men has already planned to make a break, sir.
Is he mad?
He has a certificate, sir.
It means certain death.
It is a death certificate, sir.
I see. Who is this man?
Tommy, my good man.
Well, off you go, then.
Oh, all right, Tommy.
Wait one moment. I haven't seen you around this camp before.
I didn't know you cared.
Where were you captured?
I wasn't. I was sent there by the British Army.
What's your name?
Field Marshal Echo.
Stop. Typing error.
How did you attain this rank, sir?
I was baptized Field Marshal Echo.
And of course, you've got Spike and Peter. You haven't got Harry.
Yeah, Harry's under contract to Phillips, so he's...
Yeah. But you've got up-and-coming young upstarts, Jonathan Miller and Peter Cook.
Right.
Fate, at around this time, obviously for things like Beyond the Fringe, I guess like you say, Seacombe wasn't available, it was a good opportunity to bring in the younger generation. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think so. And coincidentally, Martin was recording a new version of the Beyond the Fringe LP for the U.S. market. The original was in 1961, and he actually did three recordings of that on stage to get the final LP. He wanted to keep making sure because he really believed in that show, and for good reason. I don't know how, you know, people's backgrounds are, but I'm sure most people know Beyond the Fringe is sort of, you know, it was credited with the quote unquote satire boom, which all of them rejected.
Yeah.
So he, at this very same time, he was about to record the LP with them in Studio 2 with an invited audience of 150, 200 people. So all these lines were crossing, and I think, you know, he probably mentioned it, and, you know, whether he mentioned it to Spike or mentioned it to the Beyond the Fringe guys, probably to Spike, and he said, oh, that's a great idea, let's bring him in. There's also a third person from Beyond the Fringe.
Well, that's the thing, because I've known this LP for many, many, many years. It's very familiar. But I'd never really sat down and looked. I didn't have the LP. I only had the... I had a cassette recording of Bridge on the River Wye. And there's no credits at the end, as per, you know, for example, a Goon show.
Right.
So I just assumed, because I'd heard his voice, that Dudley Moore was involved.
Right.
But if you look on the actual LP, on the sleeve notes, there's Cook, there's Miller, there's Sellers, there's Milligan. There's even Patricia Ridgway, the recently new Mrs. Milligan. And there's a listing for a Peter Rawley, which I gather was a pseudonym for Dudley Moore.
And I've never found anything about why that was the case, because it's clearly him. And he, you know, he was, there's another thread with this, is that he was under contract as a jazz artist to Parlophone, and George Martin recorded 21 songs with him, with his trio, around this time, which was never released. And so, his involvement is sort of like he's with the Beyond the Fringe group, but it's also he's got another connection to Martin just as a musical artist.
Yeah, they couldn't use his real name for contractual reasons. And so they came up with this name, Peter Rawley, which was the name of Spike's agent at the time.
Oh, okay. That I did not know. Okay, that's good information.
So when was it, what day was it, I should know this, that Martin meets the Beatles for the first time?
So that is June 6th, and this recording is done May 23rd, and then the Fringe re-recording is June the 3rd. So this is all happening, you know, right around the same time.
Yeah.
And the Beatles are obviously the lowest priority of these three things happening at this point.
Something else that interests me about the sleeve notes, and I'm going to read the sleeve notes if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
It's quite interesting. Just in terms of how fast things were moving, it gives you a good indication. Because it says, it is not generally realized today that the beautiful English countryside bordering the River Wye was once the scene of great drama. Many years ago, one of our greatest generals was an undercover agent for MI5. He was given the code number of 000007, being given a free license to kill any gag that he didn't like. Known to the world at large as Eccles, he appeared subsequently in The Cake of the same name, terrorizing the enemies of his native land. His exploits, as you will hear, were achieved alone, unaided, and completely without a brain, for who else but Eccles could outwit a horde of Japanese soldiers and blow up a bridge with practically no arms? No mean feat, as the Orientals say. This, then, is the epic story that you're about to hear. One word of warning, for obvious security reasons, none of these men ever existed, and any resemblance to anyone either living or dead is sheer good luck. And for the best results, play this record in a circular fashion. So, what jumped out at me immediately, obviously I know that James Bond was, you know, the novels had been out for 10 years or more.
Yeah.
But they recorded this in May. Dr. No didn't come out until, was it October the 5th, the same day as Love Me Do?
Yeah.
And the LP, Bridge on the River Wye, comes out the following month.
Right.
So the sleeve notes there, when the reference to Bond, it's like Bond mania already? Is that your feeling?
Possibly so. You know, and this album has been in production since, you know, starting in May, and then the sleeve notes could have been written really at any time. Martin was, you know, working in this very small industry in London, so he would have been aware maybe of the production of Dr. No. So, you know, these things may have been filtering to him in ways that we can't know, just because, you know, we weren't there at the time. But he may have had some inkling of what was, you know, what was happening. It could just be some, you know, sort of one-off thing where Spike's or George Martin, whoever wrote this, just thinks, oh, this will be funny. This is current. This is, you know, what's on people's minds right now.
And it's also interesting to note that it's, Angela Morley, but obviously under the name of Wally Stott, the dead name Wally Stott, who's doing the music. And not, as Mark Cousins pointed out to me, not Ron Goodwin,
right,
who did all George Martin's other comedy records. Is this purely, do you think, because of the fact that it's so strongly linked to a Goon show?
I do, and I noticed this last night, and I'm convinced that there are probably more examples of this, but at least one of the pieces of music, the orchestral music, is repurposed from a Goon show. I didn't find any paperwork about re-recording that music, so I don't know if they were able to somehow. I mean, they played that live for the Goon Show, those pieces live, so I don't think they would have had a separate recording. You know, maybe it was just easier where Martin says, okay, I need these pieces. Can you come in and record this in an afternoon?
Yeah. So what else did you discover when you were at EMI?
So this is recorded in May, and then I don't see any evidence they're doing any dedicated work to it until September. So on September 20th, 8:45 a.m., Stuart Eltham is at Wellington Barracks West Guard Room for a recording of Marching Feet.
Oh, right.
And Martin had, you know, in his All You Need Is Ears book says that he went to a greengrocer's and he bought a head of lettuce and he used it as a sound effect, chopping it for decapitation. Mm-hmm. But there's no decapitation in this. So I wonder if he was thinking maybe he went to the grocer and he got, you know, leafy lettuce or something and shook that to make it sound like they're walking through the jungle.
Yes.
I don't know. Yeah. That's, you know, plausible. But so that aside from, you know, the release card, which is initially December 62, and then they push it for whatever reason to January 63. That's really the only other information I found. The rest of it has just been sort of piecing things together and listening very carefully and comparing to African Incident and literally counting sound effects. I went through and I think it's 40 different sound effects they have. Some of which are very familiar gunshots that, you know, anyone who's listening to the Goon Show will say, oh, I recognize that, you know, that sound.
Yeah. Because African Incident, the major difference is that it, in African Incident, the Germans are the oppressors. Whereas obviously, because this is a parody of, well, yeah. So it was a parody, African Incident was written to parody the film Bridge on the River Kwai. But obviously they changed it sufficiently. I wonder if they had to change it sufficiently so as not to perhaps get into trouble. And by 62, they had a bit more. Well, mind you, they couldn't use the word Kwai, could they?
Right.
But Bridge on the River Wai in 62, the Japanese are the oppressors, as in the film. We keep shuttling between the two different versions, but African Incident is quite unusual in that it's got three major characters who aren't part of the usual what I would call goon show rep company. Okay, it's got Major Spon, which is Sellers channeling Guinness, Alec Guinness.
That's it, man. Sure, we're still soldiers.
It's got Lieutenant Terence Plutt, which is Spike doing a plucky Britisher kind of character.
My name's Lieutenant Terence Plutt. Emo.
And you've got General von Gutern, again, which is Spike.
Welcome to Camp Ludendorff. My name is General von Gutern.
So, you know, you don't have characters like Minnie and Henry, you don't have Grippipe Thin. And you've also got, and it's very bizarre when it's almost jarring when you hear her speak. You've got a female,
right,
in the shape of Cecile Chevreau, who I gather was brought in because she has one scene which is a romantic scene with Bloodnock,
right.
And I gather they brought her in because Sellers would have struggled to do both together, so they needed an actual female So they asked Cecile Chevreau to come in. I don't know how they knew her or how that came about.
Is this what English call embarrassing situation?
Well, yes, I mean, after all, I mean, me halfway up a tree dressed as Timon of Athens and you whitewashing the grass, well, no one will believe us, you see.
Oh, come, Major, let us dance.
Yes, after all, even though we're in the jungle, we're still civilized, aren't we? I'll put this record on my portable military gramophone. What a strange sight it must have been. Me and the dusky beauty, tangoing through the dense jungle on foot.
I only had eyes for him, and he only had eyes for me.
That explains why we fell over a cliff.
But yeah, I mean, the Bridge on the River Wye is obviously expanded, an expanded version of African Incident, with Seagoon's part taken by other characters, largely the character of Lieutenant Cody, who's played by Jonathan Miller, I gather.
Yes.
It does quite a good American accent, I felt.
Yeah, and he has one of my favorite lines, which in total non sequitur is, here comes the major, I better get out of this dress or slip out of this dress. There are a handful of lines in this that have stuck in my brain over the years.
Yeah. And of course, at some point, probably during our recording, I'm probably going to use some racially insensitive language because I'm just quoting from the recording. Okay. Because there's references to Japs, for example.
Which I think, not to defend it, but it's reflective of not just the time, but also of the story, which is how, those officers and soldiers would have talked to each other.
It could have been worse, actually. I think it could have been worse. There's a reference to keep Japan yellow.
Yeah. So bad.
And of course, we've got the character of, Frank.
J. Ichikuchi, I realized when you were talking about Ghost of the Noonday Sun is clearly some distant cousin in Spike Milligan's mind of Dick Scratcher.
Yeah.
Just a little puerile sense of humor there.
And that Spike, that's the POW camp general. Spike doing a real, it's a very offensive voice accent that he's putting on, but it's actually quite well done. It doesn't sound like Spike.
No, he masks himself very effectively. I actually had to listen again because it's in the credits on the sleeve, but I thought, wait a minute, is that really him?
Yeah.
You all are here to work. All the prisoners in the camp work. Tomorrow, you all prisoners work on Bill Railway Bridge over River Kwai.
When you say all prisoners work, I take it you don't mean the officers.
All work. All the prisoners work. Or go back to Walla.
Perhaps you are aware of the Geneva Convention book ruling on officers?
I have not read the book of Geneva Convention or seen a film.
Nice little touch there. There's the Alec Guinness character, played by Sellers, is referred to as Major Barbara, which when I was a pretentious young teen, I went through a period of being interested in George Bernard Shaw, and that's a George Bernard Shaw play called Major Barbara.
Oh, right.
We've got Brigadier Startling Grope, which is basically Blood Knock by any other name. Sellers doesn't have a lot to do, really. I mean, he plays the lead character, I guess, which is the Guinness character. And he does play a Burmese character as well as Startling Grope, but that's it, really. And I felt that Milligan and Miller had more to do.
Yeah, I mean, I this is just an aside. This is tangential to your question, but when I first got this album years ago, I didn't have my record player set up, so I went to my parents' house and I was playing it, making a copy so I could listen at home. And it was playing through the speakers, and from the other room, my mother goes, is that Peter Sellers doing Alec Guinness? And I just thought, is it that obvious? Because I'm into it. I'm like, wow, this is, you know, listen to the production and, you know, the story and everything. But I mean, he really does stand out. I think he's so droll and so dry.
Mm.
You know, maybe he doesn't need to do. The other thing is, so here's another little bit of background that I discovered in research is, so Sellers is working, he has just finished filming the doc brief in March and April 62 at Shepperton.
Okay.
And there's a piece in the New Musical Express March 9th on George Martin's comedy records, his success with these. And so it's you know, piece focusing on him and his artist like Cribbins and Hole in the Ground. And the author asked him about Peter Sellers' apparent unwillingness to do a follow-up to his 1960 Peter and Sophia album. And Martin responds, I did hear that Peter Sellers said he would never record again, but it's my bet he'll be in the recording studios before the end of the year working on another LP. I was talking to him about this the other day. So I wonder if it's, you know, just sort of like, oh, I don't really want to do that much, but, you know, it was apparently quick money, easy money for him. That was, sure. According to, you know, Roger Lewis, that was one of the draws, is that he would get a 5% royalty, and, you know, it was half day's work, not even a half day.
Yeah, yeah.
His love and worship of Alec Guinness is fairly well known, so I think, you know, that might have played into it too. Like, oh, he gets to sort of step into Alec Guinness mode again.
If we accept your premise or your theory that George Martin was, this was all George Martin's idea to do this LP, as opposed to Spike saying to George Martin, hey, why don't we record an LP like a Goon Show? Assuming that it's George Martin's idea, I'd love to know how long it took for them to decide which Goon Show to do, and why they chose this one. I mean, I guess this one is obvious in many ways, just because of it. It's cinematic, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's got a clear plot and a through line. One of the things that saddens me a little bit is that Larry Stevens just gets written out of these things, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Because he's down as he gets a writing credit on African Incident, but he's not mentioned at all on the Bridge on the River Wye.
No,
LP.
And I mean it is revised. It's not the exact script.
Yeah.
So I wonder if he, you know, Spike's thought, well, you know, I'm rewriting this, I'm going to take sole credit, or, you know, who knows? And I mean, I think you're right. There's a possibility that Spike said, hey, why don't we do this? I've got this idea, or I've written the script. Maybe he had, you know, in this burst of creativity, he decided to rewrite this, and
maybe,
who knows? I mean, I think it's interesting that, you know, they're close enough that it could go either way, or, you know, maybe it's a two-way thing where they're discussing this and they're pitching ideas back and forth, and this sort of is the one that sticks.
Well, there's a couple of things that I've picked up on in recent months through doing this podcast. So there was the Spike Milligan documentary that aired on Sky Arts over here last year, which was all about Spike's archive, personal archive. You saw a lot of reel-to-reel cassettes of Goon Show recordings, and presumably scripts and things like that as well in his archive. And I wonder whether he, during this period in the 60s, he was listening to them, listening to the tapes, reading the scripts, even just to get ideas for new stuff, you know. And also, we know that the BBC was quite keen on the Goons coming back together to record a new series of the Goon Show, right up until sort of 61 into early 62, I think. And Spike was resistant, and Sellers was sort of indifferent, I think. Seacombe was quite keen. But so I wonder, you know, maybe Spike had, you know, maybe he had been rereading some of the old scripts and just, or listened to a recording of African Incident. and just thought, oh, that's quite a strong show. Maybe we could,
yeah,
maybe we could do an LP or do something with it, you know.
Right. And, you know, who knows, maybe there's a letter somewhere in his archive that talks about this, you know, what the motivation was.
Yeah, yeah. So does it work with the absence of Seacombe?
There's a definite difference in energy.
Yeah.
And obviously Guncho is live and it's, you know, they could crack each other up and it would be sometimes frenetic. And this was much more controlled. It had sort of had to be more controlled because of what Martin was planning to do. I think my impression is that they probably recorded them each scene separately, and then he stitched it together into the complete recording, and added the sound effects and the orchestration behind that. So, you know, it would be a much more controlled, and it sounds much more controlled. You know, it doesn't sound like the African Incident. The sort of the pace and the energy and the, you know, just
yeah,
what we all associate with the Goon Show is that kind of, there is this kind of danger to it almost. You know, like anything could happen.
It could derail at any moment.
Yeah.
Don't press that plunger. You can't press that plunger.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't. No, you can't. No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
In that opening, you have all these sound effects. You have this cinematic picture made through sound. Sound pictures, as George Martin liked to call it. So, you know, maybe it's like, I'm just going to show off my skill in, you know, conjuring this image in your mind right off and then pull you into the rest of the story.
And then you get Cook as the narrator saying, we present the bridge over the River Wye, subsequently the lawsuit over the River Wye. Which is quite
right. I really wonder prescient. If he had him come in and just re-record that line or something.
Yeah,
in light of what had happened with Columbia.
It's 1962 in England, but still 1943 in Japan, and the Japanese have just captured Singapore, and Major Barbara has been rallying the men around the white flag. Rather than surrender, we gave ourselves up, and yet again, it's Spike having a dig at the British military,
right? Lots of digs throughout.
Could you envisaged an American version of this, where the American military is sent up?
Ooh, not at that time, I don't think. I think the attitude was much, much different. I think after Vietnam, certainly.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm sorry. This was obviously not recorded during the Cuban Missile Crisis, but it was released, what, a week after the Cuban Missile Crisis? And obviously, so we've got this Japanese POW camp, and General Ichiguchi is telling them that they need to build a bridge over the river. Major Barbara objects. And then you've got 68,000 officers crammed into a small hut, 2 foot high by 6.25 inches wide. And that's where you first hear, I think it's Dudley Moore playing the character who sort of goes mad.
I can't stand it any longer. No food, no water, no milk. I can't stand it.
Steady, Mr. English. We've only been in here 14 seconds.
I know, but there's a limit to what a man can stand.
And then we have this telegram from the Emperor ordering that the bridge is to be completed by April the 1st. But unfortunately, it's April the 14th. So they, and this is the most goonish thing about this, I think, is they decide, let's work backwards, and that way it's only a fortnight away.
Right, right. And that's in the African Incident, isn't it?
It is, yes. Yeah. There's an escape committee formed, and we get Field Marshal Eccles.
Field Marshal Eccles, that was in another, it's one I listened to last night. It was either fear of wages or... I forget, but it was sort of along the same lines of like, how did you become Field Marshal Eccles? I was born Field Marshal Eccles, you know, named at birth.
And then you have the American lieutenant, although they refer to him in the British way, Lieutenant Cody. He's going to escape with Eccles. They're given concentrated licorice for some reason.
Gives a man something or does something to him. Yeah.
And then we have Cook as the narrator saying both the American and the Field Marshal escaped, except the Field Marshal. He was recaptured, clubbed, thrown over a cliff in a manner to which he was accustomed, strangled, struck on the knee, and severely reprimanded with a mallet. The tradition of visiting violence upon Eccles has carried on.
Yes.
Into the 60s.
Yes.
Clearly.
There's not so much, you know, he'll say something and they'll smack him. It's more, you know, they're reporting what's going to happen to him or what has happened to him.
I'm glad that it's funny as well because he retains the name Eccles, whereas Bloodnock is Startling Grope. But Eccles retains his name. I guess it's just because by this point, Eccles is just everyone knows the Spike Eccles character.
He's so iconic, I think.
Yeah. Lieutenant Cody turns up in Ceylon and then is told to report to Colonel Hawkins, which I guess is named Hawkins because it was Jack Hawkins played the character in the film. And then we are introduced to Brigadier Startling Grope, which is Bloodnock. Bloodnock sounding slightly more elderly. I don't know, there's something, it doesn't sound quite as robust. There's a very bad editing when he mentions the word why.
Look, according to British intelligence and a man called Tom, the Japs are forcing Allied troops to build a bridge over the Kwai. We intend to destroy it. Boom, thung, blat, kapool. That, or perhaps maybe biff, boom, thud, crash. One of those two combinations should prove fatal.
I guess George Martin did the best he could, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably him working with Stuart Eltham, who was actually probably wielding the scissors.
Oh, yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, no doubt directing him.
Mm-hmm. So basically, Startling Grope tells Cody that, according to British intelligence, there's a bridge being built and they want it blown up. So Cody is obliged to return and assist with this operation. He's parachuted into the jungle. And I love the fact that they're hacking their way through a wall of impenetrable jungle, which runs along each side of an arterial road.
Another deal with the military.
Yeah. There's these Burmese women. I'm not quite sure what the Burmese... I can't even remember from the film. There were some Burmese women in the film that were sort of attached to the raiding party, and I can't remember the reason why. But the same happens here. And of course, you've got Bloodnock or Startling Grope. While the Burmese women are bathing, he's minding their clothes.
Right.
And my favourite line in the whole story is they follow a 6-man Japanese patrol and start shooting at them.
Give them a burst. Can't you fire that gun quieter? They'll hear us killing them.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's this sort of absurdity upon absurdity. With this, which is, to me, that's the, you know, the great charm of this is that it is so ridiculous and it's so, so droll.
Yeah. So the bridge is finally completed and the men organize a concert to celebrate and they sing the German national anthem, but it's the English national anthem disguised as the German national anthem. Lieutenant Cody, is it Lieutenant Burke Pounding, which is Dudley Moore, and You Buy Dung, which is the Sellers character.
Such a terrible, terrible.
Isn't it?
That exists strictly for that one joke.
Of course it is. Yeah. They're ordered by Hawkins to place the explosives. And then you get the scene with the very short scene, which is the equivalent. It's almost identical, I think. The scene with in the Goon Show, an African incident, it's Bloodknock with Cecile Chevreau, and in Bridge on the River Wye, it's Peter Cook as Colonel Hawkins with Spike's wife,
right,
Patty,
right,
as the native girl.
Is this what English call uncompromising position?
Uncomfortable, I would say. After all, if we were caught now, what would people say? Me halfway up a mango tree, dressed as Mephistopheles, and you down there bottling fruit in a plastic kilt? It would never do.
Twan, let us dance.
What a strange sight we made. Me and her, tangoing through the steaming jungle. The silence only broken by the crackling of knees.
I only had eyes for him, and he only had eyes for me.
We fell over a cliff.
I was actually surprised on re-listen how much of African Incident ends up in this, with very few changes, if you know, any at all.
Yeah, there's obviously more. There's additional dialogue,
sure,
in this, but I mean, for example, I think I don't think in African Incident you get a character coming in and interrupting this sort of romantic scene, saying, "Hey, Major, we've done it, and so have you, by the look of it."
You're right. Yeah,
spiced up slightly. I suppose they had more license to be a bit saucier.
Yeah. Really.
Meanwhile, Eccles is waiting to press the plunger. And Major Barbara and his adjutant are walking on the bridge, and they notice, yeah, that in 10 minutes the first train will pass over. Major Barbara spots a cable down below. Eyes like a hawk and legs like a kangaroo. I wonder what he's going to do. Join a freak show. Yeah, just as in the film, there's concern that the Major will stymie the whole operation, because he's... In the film, my memory is that the Guinness character is so proud of the bridge.
Right.
That the idea of blowing it up is complete anathema to him, and he does everything he can to stop it. And that's pretty much what happens here.
Yeah. I think he says in the African Incident, I've been in the army however many years, and this is the first thing I'm really proud of. I don't know if that's from the film or if that's just, you know, sort of putting a fine point on it.
I think it's more or less that sort of sentiment.
Yeah, that's certainly the gist of it, yeah.
Because obviously, right at the first hour of the film, you've got the Guinness character absolutely vehemently against the whole idea, or certainly of himself and the officers being involved with building the bridge. Once the bridge is built, he looks upon it with a degree of pride.
Right.
And yeah, and then the Major Barbara confronts Eccles, and we have this sort of standoff with the plunger, but yeah, Eccles manages to detonate the explosive and the bridge is destroyed.
That's how it all ended. Major Barbara shot by Lieutenant Cody. Lieutenant Cody shot by the Japs. The Japs shot by Major Hawkins. And Major Hawkins killed by a falling train. A falling train shot by Major Barbara. And Major Barbara shot by Lieutenant Cody.
And to make matters worse, it was half day early closing.
Do you know what that means?
No.
No. No, I know that there was half-day early closing on Wednesdays back then, I think, for some reason. And you have this corny sort of vaudevillian outro music with a delayed cymbal crash.
Right. And to back up just a little bit before that, though, is another one of my favorite lines. I think it's Hawkins, maybe, who they're discussing how everything's set up, and he says, you know, stand by with a sack of Purple Hearts. And it's the delivery and also the sentiment behind it of you know, exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah, so it's a enjoyable little curio. It's still, you know, people still talk about it today, so it's very fondly remembered.
Yeah.
And it was just on the cusp, on the absolute cusp of George Martin's life changing irrevocably.
Right. And he had just renewed his contract at EMI around this time. So I you know, just sort of digging into the comedy aspect and, you know, maybe thinking this is where I'm going to take the rest of my career. I'm going to, you know, at least the next, you know, term of my contract.
And you'll know much more about this than I do, but if he'd not had that affair, is it possible that he would not have been told that he has to record the Beatles? Wasn't that sort of punishment?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah.
You know, sort of what the story that Mark Lewisohn put together all out of all that. And also that, you know, he, around that time, he was about to resign from EMI. And, you know, he doesn't talk about this, but maybe all this is transpiring at around the same time. He's thinking of leaving and going out on his own because he's getting this pressure because of this affair. And he's feeling, I need to get out of here. You know, I don't know, obviously, if that's the case, but I think it's plausible that it's, you know, all of this is happening in the spring of 62. And you know, as Mark Lewisohn and I were discussing years ago, he said, you know, he almost missed them, because if he'd resigned, he wouldn't have been assigned to them. He wouldn't have, you know, been made to sign them and you know, everything else that happened after that.
Sure.
So, yeah. It, you know, it's a lot of things in motion here that just sort of work out perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, I really think, you know, just beyond it being a curio related to the Goon Show, that it's, you know, it's the amount of production that George Martin put into this that I also want to call attention to, just because, you know, this period prior to the Beatles is where he's sort of, you know, working out his approach to the studio, and this is, I think, the peak of that. And, you know, working with these, you know, these people that he's had a long history with. And I mean, I think a lot of it's still very funny. Obviously, some of the humor is dated and not funny anymore and kind of cringeworthy. But I do think if you can look past that and sort of look at it with 1962 eyes and ears, it is very amusing, and it gives you a window into sort of who George Martin was at this very particular critical moment of his career.
Absolutely. Okay, so tell us a little bit more about producing the Beatles in terms of what you, because is it a regular podcast that seems to come out?
It's very irregular, yes.
Yeah.
I've been reminded of that many times by many people. It's a lot of work. I'm a, you know, one man show, so I'm producing what should reasonably take about 10 people. But it, you know, it's going into the studio, figuring out how the Beatles did what they did, how George Martin did what he did, and how that energy worked between them in, you know, different periods of their career, from early on to, you know, the middle period recordings to the, you know, the later recordings, how all of this sort of plays out. And also, you know, in many cases, looking at George Martin's history before the Beatles and saying, well, he's already encountered this idea. How did he deal with it then? And then how is he applying that knowledge to this Beatles session?
Yeah.
So, and, you know, and part of that is also just breaking down tracks and seeing how they began and then how they built up those tracks overdub by overdub. So, you know, like I said earlier, it's using the Beatles to teach music, teach concepts about recording, teach or explore ideas about collaboration and, you know, sort of what this unique chemistry between these five people was.
Would you say that the apotheosis of all this is Tomorrow Never Knows?
Yes. That's and Yellow Submarine, strangely enough, because you know, it's they are two sides of the same coin. And there's some very direct lines you can draw from Yellow Submarine to his comedy recordings, including this.
Absolutely. One. Excellent. So, yeah, so anyone with an interest in the Beatles, of course, George Martin, music in general, and music production, you're recommended to seek out Producing the Beatles, available in all the usual places. And what have you got coming up?
I will be doing an episode on Tomorrow Never Knows Soon and Yellow Submarine and these comedy recordings, which may end up being two episodes. But as you know, we sort of touched on today, it's a very large subject.
I was thinking the other day, preparing for this, I'd love to do an episode at some point on Milligan Preserved.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe you could come back sometime in the future, talk about that.
I would love to. I have a good bit of material on that, too.
Excellent. All right, well, Jason, listen, it's been brilliant having you on. Thank you so much. And we will, we'll get you back for Milligan Preserved maybe next year.
Great, yeah. Thank you for having me.